On the Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is the Murder Squad. Hello, everyone. It's that time of year where we get to talk to some of our favorite people about true crime cases. It's the winter distractions. We're currently working on the next season. We've got a lot of great cases that we're digging into of Murder Squad. But now we're digging into cases that other people have covered and some of these cases that have been adjudicated that we normally wouldn't cover on Murder Squad. It's a lot of fun. We've been doing it the entire run, and you get to meet new people and find new podcasts because everybody's looking for new content. This week, we're bringing back some old friends. Alvin and Fran are joining us to discuss a case from their hometown of Baltimore.
The case involves a man who claimed to have used his victims as food at a pit beef barbecue stand. The killer was only convicted of two killings, as well as a kidnapping and attempted sexual assault. But he claimed to have killed over 10 people. To go through this bizarre case, we have Affirmative Murders, Alvin and Fran. Hey, guys, how's it going?
Hey, what's going on, guys?
So, Alvin, you're from Baltimore. There's a lot of crime in Baltimore. Typically, because of the show The Wire, a lot of people equate Baltimore with a lot of drug violence, gang violence.
Yes.
This case is different.
This case is very different, yes. Traveling around and you say that you're from Baltimore, you get a lot of excitement for people to bring up The Wire and mention it and talk about, you know, the drugs and the corruption and everything like that. But this is it's like a movie. This is very different than what you would think of when you think of Baltimore crime.
So walk us through who Joe Metheny was, because when you do, I will say this, when you do a initial search, if you type in Joe Metheny into Google search and you look at images, the first image that comes up, he looks like he's the professional wrestler King Kong Bundy. That's the best way I can describe him. He looks like, and he's almost in a wrestling pose in a sense.
Yeah, he almost looks like Guy Fieri and like a character from Deliverance, or it's a very odd look that he's got going on, but absolutely terrifying. And he's huge as well.
Yeah, he's a big, big guy. All right. So walk us through this guy. So he was, you know, where was he from? What was his family situation like? And what was he doing in his early life?
So he's from Maryland. There's debate on his childhood upbringing. According to him, it was very rough. His dad was an alcoholic and a drug abuser. His mom was also into drugs and was not home very often. Again, according to him, his mom begs to differ and says, you know, I worked a lot, but, you know, you guys ate, you know, if you look at Joe Metheny, I don't think anybody would debate that he, you know, was not eating. That was right. What he was, you know, kind of was a big thing that he was saying. When he was 18, he went to the army. And according to him, he was stationed in Vietnam. His mother says he went to Germany. The Vietnam conflict was over when he enlisted. So, you know, but he doesn't really care what his mom thinks anyway. He gets out of the army. He comes back to Baltimore. He's from South Baltimore. It's where he grew up. And also, if you watch The Wire, season two of The Wire depicts South Baltimore very accurately, in my opinion. So if you want to understand the whole, like, what's up, hon? And what's going on over there? And it's O's and, you know, hot dogs, all that stuff it's very in like doc life. It's very accurately depicted in season two of The Wire. But he turned his back on his family to live this kind of street bridge, under the bridge type of life, because he was had some substance abuse problems. And yeah, so he came home from the army and just chose a life of like dumpster can fire, drinking fifths of alcohol life over his family. That's kind of the direction he chose to go in.
Right, he originally started doing drugs while he was in the military.
Yes, that's where he developed his habit. Yes. Yeah.
So what was his drug of choice in the military?
Heroin and crack cocaine and alcohol.
Okay. Well, he would be when he was in the military, he might have just been doing cocaine, but crack hadn't come out yet.
Then my mistake. Then heroin and alcohol, and then
right.
He made it through the 80s crack epidemic, You get to Joe in the 90s. He's doing all three, a hat trick.
Right. Okay. So by the 90s, he's going by the nickname Tiny.
Yes.
Which is what you do. Yeah. You know, he's 6'1". He's probably over 300 pounds.
Close to five.
So, yeah, like 450.
Close to five, really. Close to five. Is that, yeah. I mean, just when I say King Kong Bundy, if anybody, you know, Google King Kong Bundy, then Google this guy and then put him next to each other. They look very similar.
For anybody who's seen that one episode of Boy Meets World, I don't know much about wrestling. I don't know if he was real, but there was Vader was on an episode of Boy Meets World and he was huge. So
yes.
If you remember Vader, big guy, but he might have been, I mean, 500 pounds is massive. So he might have been bigger than even a wrestler that you're thinking of.
No, Vader was a real wrestler.
Okay.
His name was Big Van Vader.
Big Van Vader.
He actually, one side note, he actually fought Lawrence Taylor, wrestled Lawrence Taylor in one of the WrestleManias. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So, oh no! Wait a minute. That was Bam Bam Bigelow. I'm sorry. Thank God I said that. I was going to get. There's going to be one wrestling fan that's going to.
You don't know anything about wrestling.
Yeah, I don't
one
even
star,
have a clue what
bullshit,
you guys are talking
canceled.
About here.
Okay. By the way, Paul watched no television growing up. He was just outside the whole time. So, if you want to talk about making a tourniquet for a wound or something, or digging a trench or something along those lines, that was what Paul was doing. Meanwhile, I was in an air-conditioned room watching, you know, cartoons and Bob Ross.
You get me.
All right. So when does he get on the police's radar?
Oh, he doesn't get on the police's radar for some time. When they eventually arrest him, he confesses to all kinds of stuff. You know, I believe he was making up a lot of things. But one thing that is for sure is he turned his back on his life of street urchinry and bought a trailer, got married and had a child. And at some point, his wife was also had substance abuse problems. And one day he comes home from the trailer and she's taken the child. She's left. She's apparently stolen some of the items from the trailer, which made him very angry. And he storms out and spends the next few months like searching under bridges and all the places that they were that she was known to, you know, participate in drug abuse, looking for her. He didn't find her, but he found his first victim.
Well, before that part, mm-hmm. What really ticked him off was that his old lady that left him with her drug dealer, whatever, got busted for drugs and their child got taken away.
Yes.
For child abuse and neglect. So that's what really set him off. And he couldn't go get his child back because of his past criminal history. So that's what really ticked him off.
Yes. So she took the child, but then the man that she left Joseph for convinced her to enter into sex work to make money. They got busted. They lost custody of the child. So he finds this out and now he's already angry. They took, you know, all his knickknacks and stuff from his trailer. Now it's gone to somewhere else and he the violence just spills over. And that is when his first known murder takes place in 1994 with Kathy Ann Magaziner. And it was a very violent attack. She was a sex worker as well. And then it starts from there and just goes for years. She wasn't even discovered for a couple of years.
So it almost sounds like he was on a potential comeback. You know, I mean, he moves away from the homeless camps. He starts, you know, he gets a trailer. He gets married. He has a kid. I think he was working as a forklift driver.
Yes.
And then, you know, the wife leaves him with the kid and he's, you know, I mean, that's a story of like now he's searching for his kid and then something that switches and then he decides to go off the deep end.
Yeah, I believe it was he always clearly had issues with his mother. And then his wife leaves him, turns to a life of sex work. Now he's angry at sex workers and he directs his anger at these women in his lives to anybody in his pathway. I mean, there was no like there was no like means to his violence. The victims were random, other than the fact that they were people that were also living in homeless camps. So, you know, these people develop relationships with each other. They, you know, share things with each other. They know each other, but he didn't pick his victims based on that. But I'm sure there was some level of familiarity with the people.
Yeah. Well, with some of his earliest victims, in his confession, he did say that, he tried to go after the ones that may have information on where his ex-wife is.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so he was saying that he was using that as an excuse. He was trying to
interrogate, and then they didn't give him the answers. And
so, you know, Paul, have you ever had to, you know, when somebody goes missing from a homeless encampment, it's incredibly rare that they're ever reported as being missing. But, you know, people do get, you know, there are fights during homeless encampments that, you know, bodies are often found. Have you ever had to deal with working a case or on or around a homeless encampment?
You know, I actually had staff at the DA's office that frequently had to go track down, you know, witnesses to homicides or sexual assaults in homeless encampments. You know, and it is very difficult because, of course, there's no address. You know, these guys and girls move around all over the place. And so, you know, my investigators were literally having to get to know and establish rapports, you know, sort of with the established people in the area to be able to go to them and say, hey, I'm looking for so and so, you know, and so it's very much word of mouth. You have to have photos of the person. You know, most of these people have some sort of mugshot. So those mugs are taken in and then say, hey, I'm looking for this person. Where's this person at? But it is very tough to track them down. And most certainly, you know, they move around a lot. So if somebody just happens to not show up one day where they're typically, you know, they're housing themselves up, nobody cares. You know, it's just like, oh, he's just moved on. So yeah, you could go months, if not years, before anybody even realizes that something has happened.
Now, he meets Kathy Ann. He lures her to his home. What happens then?
He sexually assaulted her and murdered her pretty brutally. And then he buried her on the work site where he was a forklift operator. And then, again, according to him, a lot of the stuff is, I think he was starting to buy into the excitement.
I think he was fabricating a lot.
There was a lot of stuff that seems fabricated. But he confessed, and in his confession, he said that 6 months after he killed Kathy, he dug her body up, defiled her skull, and then put it in a box and threw that away separately from the body. It might have just been he has a lot of these weird little touches that he adds to his stories. To like, he wants to be like, he's known as a sick guy. Bit. Yeah, exactly. He like wants to have that kind of element. And if you see him, he's very rock and roll, grunge, you know, so I think he really started to just buy into it. But he disposed of her on his work site. Yeah.
So after that, he runs into Randall Brewer and Randy Piker.
Yes.
What is that situation?
So again, like Fran said, he believed that Randall and Randy, two separate people, Randall and Randy had done drugs with his wife at some point, so they might have some information on her. Apparently, things got a little heated and he had an axe and attacked both of them with an axe. Again, he's a very big guy. So when you talk about like quick attacks, the close range, you're pretty much done. Yeah, you're done. So he took both of them out and brutally hacked at them with an axe until they were dead. And this actually is a really complicated story here because this was his first run-in with police, but it didn't go how you would expect. Apparently, there was another gentleman at this tent city who used the axe in another crime, and that kind of diluted the evidence. So when Joe was arrested for these two murders, he did about 2.5 years awaiting trial. But then when he went to trial, the case was dismissed for lack of evidence.
Because the murder weapon, did they eventually find the murder weapon, or was it gone?
Well, they said it was used in, I read that it was used in another crime. But I don't know if they actually ever officially like recovered the weapon, or if this is all just confessions from people who were arrested.
Right.
Trying to place blame and get their sentence reduced by implicating somebody else. I don't know if a weapon was ever recovered. I would say no, because the lack of physical evidence would tell me that they didn't have.
Yeah, because Paul, if they were, you know, listen, you have an axe at this homeless encampment. One guy kills two people with it. Another guy steals it. This guy named Larry Amos, he steals the weapon and he kills a man named Everett Dowell. This is a little bit before DNA was being used, but are you going to be able to identify that they're, you know, the two victims on it? Or three victims?
Well, you know, in 1995, that really is at the very beginning in which a very rudimentary DNA typing technology was coming into labs, this DQ alpha and possibly polymarker system. You could see that you would have a mixture. But if you, you know, in essence, you would not know. It'd be very tough to say, oh, I've got, you know, two distinct individuals based on the limited information that you could get from this DNA testing. You know, I think it's interesting in terms of, you know, these crimes that we've talked about to this point with Kathy Magaziner and then the two men. You know, you have a sex worker, which he's now saying that, you know, after he buried her in a grave, he dug up her body and had sex with it. This is significant from my perspective. You know, yes, and maybe he is just trying to sound, you know, more sick, and he never did that. However, this is something where, you know, when I talk about serial predators, this is something that I point out routinely, and I use the phrase "know thy enemy," because these guys do things that aren't normal. And this is where oftentimes in these types of cases, evidence is missed because you go in, you know, a body's recovered, it goes into the coroner's office and the pathologist says, I'm not doing a sex kit. That woman has been dead for weeks. Well, who's to say that the offender didn't have sex with her yesterday, even though she had been dead for weeks? Do a sex kit, you know, swab, collect the DNA evidence, because you have these offenders that have these paraphilias. You know, so now you have Joe saying, well, he put her body, had sex with it after, I don't know what, how long of time of it was after he had buried it and then had possibly defiled her head. This is what Ted Bundy would do. You know, this rings true to me. This is in 1995. You know, so is he just throwing out trying to make himself a bigger, badder serial killer? Or is he really talking about the types of paraphilia activities that he was engaged in? You know, so now he elevates, in my mind, as a predator, because this is sounding authentic. And it's like, okay, what else has he done?
Oh.
That was deep.
You just wait. Yeah. You just wait.
Also, it did say that he went back 6 months after he buried the body.
Yeah.
To go and, you know, do sexual things with the skull.
And I will say, because I, you know, I've dug up bodies that have been buried for 6 months. And I've got one case in which this woman had been killed and buried in a shallow grave for 6 months. And when she was dug up, you would not know she had been dead for 6 months. It looked like she had been dead for maybe a week, you know, because the way that she had been wrapped in plastic and buried, the insects couldn't get to her. It was during the colder seasons. Her body had been preserved. So with Kathy Magaziner, you know, it's sort of like, well, what did she look at that time? You know, was she truly skeletal? You know, he's saying with her skull, but, you know, how much of the skull, how much flesh was still on the skull? I mean, you're generally not going to be having sex with a true skeletal skull with just bone. But if there is still flesh on there, then you can see where that offender is possibly accomplishing a sex act and possibly leaving DNA evidence. And I would say, yeah, you could possibly recover his DNA.
I don't think they did that. I think they were just like, whatever, man. Sure, you did. Seven.
Yeah. And this is where you see evidence being missed. You know, that's where it's like you have to understand these guys do things. There's textbook examples of guys ejaculating into stab wounds. How many CSIs are dipping a swab into a stab wound looking for semen? Probably very little. And this has been something that I have been talking about for years. What you have to recognize when you are dealing with something unusual, step back and then now really get outside of the norm and try to go after the evidence that you think is, oh, there's just no way. Well, guess what? There's very, very likely there is evidence there.
So does he get out of jail then? So he's out of prison.
Yes, he does 2.5 years waiting for his trial. The trial gets dismissed and he's back on the street. And none of that time sitting in prison helped at all.
So what happens then?
Well, it seemed like if you asked him, he would probably say his initial killings were an act of sort of vengeance, looking for his wife, not getting the answers that he wants. And then, you know, the anger takes over or whatever. But when he comes out of prison, it clearly became more of a sport for him. And this is where things take a really crazy turn. He gets out. He talks his way back into his job. He gets a new setup. He talks as the boss of the place where he was working as a forklift operator, as he goes, you know, hey, man, you know, at nighttime, people can come and steal these pallets. So you need security. So I'll sleep here on the property in the trailer. You let me, you know, get me housed, and I'll just keep things safe here at night. You know, admittedly, he would be probably an intimidating presence, right. But I mean, they're pallets. But it worked. You know, he's like Leo DiCaprio in that Catch Me If You Can movie. He talked his way into it. And he sets up shop here on this property, and he goes right back into killing. He starts luring sex workers in to his property with promises of drugs, and he killed two women who were unidentified, I believe. Again, he's naming so many victims, and like Paul was saying, you know, when you're talking about these tent camps, these homeless encampments, people are going by aliases, random names. So, you know, I agree with everything Paul said. You want to believe him and take him at his word, but I don't know some of the victims that he's naming. They don't have names. So, but apparently, this is where it gets crazy. He opened up a burger stand. So he hacked up these women. And
now these women were, this was Kimberly Lynn Spicer.
Yes, Kimberly Lynn Spicer. Sorry.
Now she was a single mom. He lures her to his trailer. He stabs her, and he hides her at the factory site, and he asks a friend to help bury her. And the owner of the factory place was arrested eventually as being an accessory for disposing of evidence.
Yes.
He attempted to rape and probably kill Rita Kemper, but she escaped. And he actually told her, I'm going to kill you and bury you in the woods with the other girls. But she was able to escape through a window, and then she called the police, and that was how he was caught. But when did he start spinning these tales then about what he had done to these women and the idea of this barbecue situation?
Well, so after Rita Kemper escaped, you know, thankfully this man is massive. He doesn't have much wind. So he actually saw, I mean, she jumped over a fence that had barbed wire at the top of it. Mm-hmm. And then he saw her getting into, flag down a truck and get in and escape.
She climbed like 10 feet high worth of pallets.
Yeah.
He said to get to this gate and hop over this barbed wire. Yeah.
Yeah. So she escapes. Not long after that, he was brought into custody, and they thought it was going to be a more of a fight because, again, I can't even really, you got to just Google the guy's name to understand how absolutely immense this person. Yeah. I mean, he's a very big person. So the police showed up thinking there was going to be a fight, but he gave himself up pretty willingly and immediately started confessing to crimes. And within these confessions, he was saying how he opened up a pit beef stand and was using human remains from his victims that he hacked up to hide their bodies, because after he got out of prison, I guess he moved on from, he was throwing women in rivers and burying them in the woods. But according to him, when he got out, he changed his tactics up, started hacking these people up and disposing of the not meaty parts, as he described them. And he started making special meat, which was a combination of beef, pork, and people meat, which apparently, according to him, pork and people meat are very close in taste. So there's a little fun fact for you guys. And he would make burgers and serve them to people.
Which means he probably has personal experience in tasting human remains.
I would say so. I mean, I don't think this guy's palate is, I don't think he's like a picky eater. So, yeah.
Well, that's what he said. He said, I opened up a little open pit. Now, this was during an interview. He said, I opened up a little open pit beef stand. I had real roast beef and pork sandwiches. They were very good. The human body tastes very similar to pork. If you mix it together, no one can tell the difference. He also said, the next time you're riding down the road and you happen to see an open pit beef stand that you've never seen before, make sure you think about this story before you take a bite of that sandwich.
Oh, boy. The things that when we covered this story, it changed everything. The first Thanksgiving after we did this story, I almost shot put it the tray of turkeys of turkey meat.
Yeah.
Like Miss Trunchbull and Matilda, because there was no bone in the tray. It was just the meat. So it was like, I need to see the, I don't trust just loose meat. I don't like, I went months of just not trusting meat. And then if you're from Maryland or like the East Coast area, a pit beef sandwich is basically thin sliced sandwich meat, hot sandwich meat. And I haven't eaten pit beef since I found out about this story. It just, I don't trust it.
That's the way it's delicious. So I'll continue there.
Fran has no qualms.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a little human in there, no problem.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting, Alvin, that you described him as Guy Fieri, though. Guy Fieri mixed with Van Vader when, you know, Guy Fieri potentially would have gone to this place.
Oh,
in,
man.
In one of
yeah.
his shows, you know?
Yeah.
Flavor so, time. And believe me, we're trying to be as respectful as we can with this. We don't
it's
know
insane.
If this was true or yes. not. But Paul, when it comes to, you know, the reason why this case got so much press and continues to stick around is because of this claim, the claim about the barbecue beef. We have heard about this before. This has been proven. People have certainly done this before.
Sure.
They did. There's a whole play. You know, the Barber of Seville is all about that. You know, Sweeney Todd putting him putting into meat pies.
Oh, yeah.
Every time I hear this story, all I think is fried green tomatoes, because that is what they do with Ruth's abusive husband.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. They knock him out and he gets put into the barbecue.
Oh,
wow.
So every time I, especially because it's barbecue, every time I hear it, I think fried green tomatoes. Every time.
How would you potentially go about, because I know people are thinking it, proving this in a court of law, if you needed to? Or is this something where they just said, we've got him on everything else, we don't need to go into it?
Yeah, well, you know, in terms of proving it, and it depends on how contemporaneous, you know, the testing can be to, you know, the recovery of the remains as well as whatever is being served at this barbecue pit. But, you know, fundamentally, it would be DNA testing. You know, the DNA typing technology is human specific. So even though it may be mixed with pork and or beef, you could go in there and actually get a DNA profile, you know, from this mixed sample, because the DNA technology would ignore the other animal DNA that is present. So that would be relatively easy if they could get a sample of it. Of course, you know, recovery of the remains, wherever, you know, the bodies were disposed and the conditions of the remains, taking a look at, you know, do you have evidence of the processing of these remains to strip flesh off of it? You know, has it been through a meat grinder? Has it been through some, you know, aspects, you know, the different types of tools being used to also corroborate his statement that he had processed some of these bodies in order to be used as meat for his barbecue pit. So it's, you know, there's a variety of ways that could have been done. It's just, you know, were they done, or was, you know, the type of once law enforcement and authorities got this knowledge, you know, was that evidence still in existence? You know, and if it wasn't, then no. Now it's just him making those claims. And, you know, and it's one of those things where, from a prosecution standpoint, you know, the homicide, the murder is the charge. You know, now when you get into this disposal of the body, cutting up the body, serving the body, you know, these are lesser, far lesser crimes. And if the prosecutor doesn't feel that they contribute to the case, or is just going to muddy the case in the jury's eyes, they're not even going to present it. You know, they're going to, if they've got them solid on a homicide, on a murder, they're going to put that evidence forward and get him convicted for life and or the death penalty.
Okay. All right. So he gets caught on December 15th. He confesses to the murders. He leads authorities to Kathy Ann's remains. She's identified through dental records. And he claimed to have three additional victims that he found on Washington Boulevard in Baltimore. And according to his confession, he also threw bodies into the Patapsco River, but they never found any other bodies. So he claimed 10 victims total, including the homeless men. What happens at his trial?
At his trial, he pleads guilty to the murder of Kathy Magaziner, and he was sentenced to life in prison. He was given the death penalty, but it was overturned in the year 2000, and it was overturned and turned into life without parole instead. which a lot of people are upset about, because when you read these stories and you fall into the tales, like Paul said, they, you know, they went after the case that they could prove, which was what he confessed to and the body that they had. But, you know, if you let him spin his tail, he had victims upwards of 10. There's some people that says at some points he said he started killing people back in 1978. So people think, you know, if you're a fan of the death penalty, they're like, how this is the candidate that they, you know, who, this is the kind of evil that you that is that this is supposed to be reserved for. But it was overturned and he ended up, you know, spending about close to 20 years in prison until he died of natural causes in August of 2017. He was, you know, had been doing drugs for a long period of his life, and he was morbidly obese. So heart gave out, something of that sort. He was 62.
So during the sentencing, he said some things. He said he enjoyed the killing.
Oh, yeah. He said, oh, man. Yeah, he said a lot of
Said he got a rush out of it, got a high out of it. Those are quotes. And he also added he had no real excuse why other than I like to do it. He went on to say the words "I'm sorry" will never come out, for they would be a lie. I am more than willing to give up my life for what I have done, to have God judge me and send me to hell for eternity.
Those are pretty, I mean, that's a lot of conviction there.
Yeah.
He meant that.
Well, Paul, looking into potential other murders that have happened around this thing, you know, listening to what he might have said at his sentencing, you know, he's owning it. And he sounds like a guy that has definitely killed multiple people. Would he really have just started? Was this the switch that was turned when he lost his wife and kid? That certainly could have been it before he actually started killing. Or did he kill before that?
Well, you know, as we're going through this case, you know, and we're in 1994, we're looking at Kathy magazine, or, you know, and he's lost his wife and his kid. And now he's using that as an excuse to go and try to track down them, and then running across Kathy, you know, and now he's angry. You know, this is what we call a stressor in this predator's life, you know, and it's a trigger. There's a wide variety of different types of stressors. It could be work related, it could be relationship related, etc. Here it's relationship related. And he now starts going on this, you know, over the next course of the next 2 years, you know, basically going into a predator mode and killing sex workers, as well as other homeless people. I would say that going back to, you know, when he's in his late teens to early 20s, this is when he's probably now starting to experiment with the idea of killing people. You know, so is it possible going back to 1978? Has he done other crimes, whether it was when he was in the military? Did he do other crimes when he was, you know, in this homeless lifestyle? I say that is absolutely possible with this guy. You know, if he's telling the truth, if he's sitting here and he's beating his chest about how badass he is as a serial killer, he's digging up bodies after 6 months and having sex with their skulls and this and that. You know, there's a good likelihood that this guy is a true predator who has been killing for a long time. And you look at with these known victims, whether he was convicted or suspected of since 1994. They're sex workers, they're individuals in homeless encampments. You know, he is going to a victim pool that he is familiar with. This all rings true. You know, this is where, you know, again, barriers to the offense. You know, what is the offender comfortable with? If he's saying in 1994, he's picking up Kathy and she's a sex worker, he likely has comfort in picking up sex workers. And even though he was married and had a child, he likely was soliciting sex workers and getting familiar with that culture before he escalates to where now he is going to lure a sex worker out of that environment to and isolate her to where he can do what he wants to do, which is to kill her. So I'm looking at this and I'm saying everything about this case harkens that this guy likely probably is, you know, he's telling the truth. He's got more victims than what law enforcement knows about, you know, and that's where I would lean towards. Okay, let's take a look at what happened before 1994. And then, you know, with the victim pool the homeless encampments. Mm-hmm. He knows that he's probably committed crimes that he never has to confess to, because he knows that those victims will never be identified or ever be missed. He knows that.
Right.
You know, so, you know, he's probably got more victims than he's even saying that he has.
So, Fran and Alvin, what are your final thoughts on this? And what was the reaction when you did this on Affirmative Murder?
Frank, go first.
Yeah. So, like, you know, the first time I did this story, you know, the biggest headline of the story is, you know, he chopped up people and served it to people in his pit beef stand. So that headline is very, you know, eye-catching. It makes you want to go, oh, I need to do more, especially with his big picture up and him look like a bear and growling. It's like, yeah. Oh, I need to do more research on this. Now, the case is horrific and everything he did was horrific. I'm not saying that he didn't do anything to, you know, commit those crimes to the women and men, you know. Rest in peace to them. But I do think, honestly, that, you know, going over the story again, that he kind of boosted up the type of person that he wanted to be recognized as after it's all said and done. I did think that he was trying to put out an image as far as him being this crazy serial killer, but he didn't have time to do that. He didn't have enough time to do that since he got caught, since one of them escaped. So in his confession, he tried to go, you know, I killed this many people. And then it's like, two was like, you know, was buried in a river. They couldn't find them. So those are, you know, undiscovered bodies that nobody knows anything about. And then it was like, if you go back to the beginning of the story where he, you know, was kind of like making up his childhood and, you know, what he did when he went in the military was a lie because his mom was like, you know, that's not true. So I do think that he kind of boosted up his story just a little bit. Now, and the only thing that, you know, as far as evidence, as far as, you know, the him eating the human meat, that's just from his confession. There's no, they didn't, like you said, Paul, they didn't do the research or the, you know, to dig more into that to see if that was actually true. That's just from him saying that, and we don't know if that's true or not. But that's the biggest headline of the story of him eating people.
Captivating.
Right. So captivating. That's how I honestly think. I kind of think he boosted up himself a little bit. And then at the end of his confession, he goes, you know, next time you go to a pit beef stand, remember me or whatever, because you never know if you're going to be eating somebody.
Yeah, it was like some Truman Capote.
Yeah, so it was like,
you know, a turn of phrase at the end.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was just like one of the things where it's like, I'm trying to put out there, like, I want you guys to remember me and don't forget what I did or what I supposedly did or whatever. That's just my honest opinion.
Gotcha. Jeez. Wow. Okay.
Well, you know, and I will say, you know, to Fran's point, you take a look, you know, who is the one big cannibal serial killer out there at this point in time? It was Jeffrey Dahmer. And I had to look it up. Yeah. Jeffrey Dahmer had been apprehended in 1991. You know, so you could see where somebody might be trying, if they're looking for attention, trying to spin themselves into a Dahmer-like character, because he's in the press, you know, apprehended in 1991. He's going through trial. It's rather contemporaneous. You know, so there could be some exaggeration that's going on just so he looks better. He wants that. I don't know if you want to call it. He wants to have some sort of legendary status attributed to him because he knows he's been caught.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. So, gentlemen, thank you so much for bringing this case to us.
For sure.
What's been going on in your lives? Fran, are you still with the United States Postal Service?
I am.
It's a pretty slow time of year, though, right?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Oh, no. This is peak season.
This is like the slowest time, right? Christmas. The Christmas lull, they call it.
The Christmas lull, they call it. Yeah. All right. And then I thought of you because on your bio, it says that you're really into peanut butter cups, as I am as well.
Yes.
Now, is that Alvin or was that Fran?
Oh, that's Fran.
That's me.
That's Fran. Yeah. Now, did you see the peanut butter cup pie that came out?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it was not a pie. It was a peanut butter cup.
It's just a huge giant.
But the people at Hershey's, the evil monsters that they are, only made 1,000 of them. And then there was like a huge rush to try and get them right before Thanksgiving.
Are you about to flex and be like,
it is right here.
Yeah. Well, you know, welcome to my world. If it's food related, Billy knows about it.
I follow a lot of food Instagrammers. What can I say?
Yeah. I come to find out when you like Reese's, I love Reese's, but if it's not the original size, when they go and make, like, for example, they have like the big cup with extra peanut butter. it doesn't taste the same. When they try to put these alternate, you know, kinds of Reese's out, it just doesn't taste the same.
He's a Reese's purist.
He's a Reese's purist.
I understand.
Well, the only one out of all the holiday ones that actually tastes close and good is the egg.
I love the egg.
Yeah, the egg's the only one that really works.
I love a little bit more peanut butter. I like a little bit more peanut butter to it. Yeah. All right.
You know, Billy, they have ones that do that as well.
I know.
So, I'm just trying to contribute.
Are you still obsessed with watching cult documentaries?
Oh, man, big time. Just started watching. They have a show dedicated to cults on Discovery Plus. It's escaping my name right now, but they do it. Oh, man, they really lay it out, all the details, and it's insane. Keith Raniere. I'm checking up. I'm going back and watching old tapes constantly. Yeah. Oh no, I'm a big cult guy.
Okay.
Super. Yeah.
All right. So what can we expect in the new year for Affirmative Murder? How long? What year are you guys into now? Is this the third year?
Fourth year. Man, time flies.
Wow.
2022. We actually not too long ago we started opening up our podcasts and doing these almost like town halls and letting women call in and tell us their experiences with being harassed on the streets and sexual harassment and assault encounters, just because we're two dudes who don't have to walk through life experiencing that. So we just wanted to kind of hear it firsthand and also open up the platform to let people speak those truths out to, you know, whoever needs to hear them or people who didn't know that this was a thing. So we hope to be doing a few more of those in next year. And because they were really, it was really cool. It was a really powerful experience that we had.
That's awesome. All right. And where can everybody find you?
Everywhere, man. If you type Affirmative, and this, it's been 4 years, but initially there was a lady who kind of looked like Nancy Grace. She had this Affirmations podcast. She'd be the number one when you type in Affirm.
Yeah.
I think we took her spot. We jumped over her. Right. And now if you type in Affirm anywhere, we're coming up on that thing.
Yeah.
Social media, podcast apps, you know, wherever you need to find us. If you go on some of these like Nextdoor apps, you might be able to contact me. I can come over and rake your leaves. We're just doing it all. We're just doing everything we need to do. We're just trying to get our name out there. And, you know, we appreciate you guys letting us using your platform to boost our platform. Thank you for that.
Appreciate you.
If you guys need your lawns trimmed or leaves raked, you know, it's... Affirm. Type in Affirm anywhere. You'll find us.
We can just find out.
I just want to have some beers and watch some cult docs with you, man.
Or that too. I'm great.
Do
great
that next time. We weren't able to do that because when we had the holiday party this year, which you did show up at, which was awesome.
I did show up at that. Yeah. Fun.
Everybody, thanks so much for joining us on this winter distraction. Rate, review, subscribe. Remember, we will be back in about 8 more weeks with the Murder Squad. But until then, follow us on social. We'll be talking about true crime news. We'll be giving you updates on everything that's going on with the cases that we covered over the last 3 seasons. And until then, keep digging.
Keep digging. And thank you, Alvin and Fran.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Paulie Katowski. Associate producer, Haley Gray. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgara, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.